The bottom line is it would be a catastrophic war if this turns into combat.
Another week, another North Korea missile. It's Tuesday, May 30th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well online at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, China seeks to win hearts and minds through soft power. China builds its presence in the developing world, conserving food in Australia, replacing burned skin, and students learning by hacking the military. We divulge what we know right now on VOA Asia. North Korea fired a short-range ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan that Tokyo said fell within its exclusive economic zone Monday after reaching an altitude of 120 kilometers and a distance of about 450 kilometers. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis warned Pyongyang poses a direct threat to the United States, even without an intercontinental ballistic missile, as well as a threat to the Northeast Asian region.
We are working with the international community to deal with this issue. This regime is a threat to the region, to Japan, to South Korea. And in the event of war, they would bring danger to China and to Russia as well. But the bottom line is it would be a catastrophic war if this turns into combat, if we're not able to resolve this situation through diplomatic means.
Mattis declined to say what would constitute a red line that would trigger a conflict. He said the United States has worked with China, and Beijing has tried to be helpful. Former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer Cedric Layton, now head of his own crisis management consultancy, tells VOA the launch of the Scud-class missile is designed to send a message to Pyongyang's neighbors.
They want their neighbors to be aware that they not only have the capability to strike them, but that they are willing to do so with impunity. So this is very dangerous from a destabilization standpoint. It is something that I think will serve to increase tensions on the Korean Peninsula and in East Asia in general. The other part of this is that because it came so close and possibly entered into the Japanese economic zone, it clearly shows that they are not only challenging South Korea, but Japan as well, and by extension, the United States. But it also is a message to the North Korean people that the North Korean government is going to stake everything on maintaining their independence and their isolation.
Monday's missile test was the third in 3 weeks, and the third since South Korean President Moon Jae-in took office May 10th, vowing more engagement with Pyongyang. Bill Richardson, former U.S. Congressman, governor of New Mexico, U.N. ambassador, and a negotiator with North Korea, tells VOA's Ira Melman about how best to deal with the situation.
This is their ninth missile test. I don't think their technology is strong enough to reach the U.S. with their missiles, but this means that the United States, South Korea, Japan, and especially China that has leverage on North Korea needs to do more to try to rein them in. But with this new North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, you don't know what he wants. You know what he stands for. He's unpredictable. So we've got an enigma situation.
So what do you do with it? Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, said working with the United States will take specific action to deter North Korea. He continues to say working with the United States will take specific action to deter North Korea. He said that on Japanese television. Do you think the Japanese and the United States have any plan in place, or is this just something he said out of thin air?
Well, I believe what's going to happen is more sanctions by the United Nations, banking sections that have bite with Chinese banks on North Korea. I think they will have an effect. I think China will continue to pressure North Korea, not as much as it should on coal and oil exports. I think there will be a succession of other initiatives like cyber efforts to try to deter North Korea's missile and nuclear technology. But I think talking about preemptive military strikes where we've got 80,000 troops in Japan, we've got 25,000 troops in South Korea, we've got 25 million South Koreans around Seoul and the DMZ that would be vulnerable. I think you need a diplomatic new strategy that does involve Japan, that does involve South Korea, that does involve China and the U.S., But that is being developed now, my hope is. But I think talking about preemptive military strikes in a tinderbox area in the Korean Peninsula is not the best policy.
Well, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said yesterday on Sunday TV, as you probably know and have heard about, that it would be a catastrophic war if it turns into combat. You agree?
I do agree. I do agree. That doesn't mean, though, we don't respond in some capacity, like an anti-missile system with South Korea, the THAAD. I think that is needed. I do think we need to have very strong military exercises with South Korea and Japan. We have to send a signal that we are ready to defend the peninsula, work together under the treaty, and that North Korea cannot continue this bullying. But at the same time, in the end, I think North Korea is going to need energy assistance. They want sanctions dropped. They're going to need food. You've got a lot of starving people. I think a deal long-term that will probably mean North Korea try to get them to moratorium on missile and nuclear technology. Try. It's not going to be easy because you've got a different son running North Korea than the father, who in general you could make a deal with.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and also visit our voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Philippine forces make gains in southern city under siege. Japan public split on idea to cite military in constitution. Indonesia names Islamist leader a suspect in pornography case. Indian government-owned rail network hires 23 transgender people. Popular Chinese lesbian dating app removed from the internet. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. On the political and military front, U.S.-China relations have often been a tense dance between governments. However, in arts and education, many say the relationship is deepening. Some say this is progress, bringing economic and cultural benefits for citizens from both countries. And as VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles, others are much more skeptical.
There has been a growing interest in having children learn Chinese among American parents.
Jobs for young people, if they know Chinese, if they know English, if they have some cultural experience, international experience, that can really put them at a different place.
China has been funding some of the Chinese language and culture programs through its Confucius Institutes. Mandarin immersion teacher Carol Chen says the University of California, Los Angeles Confucius Institute has been providing support here at Broadway Elementary, one of L.A.'s public schools.
One of the year they actually brought in the Chinese folk culture tradition to the campus.
China funds close to 500 Confucius Institutes globally, most located on university campuses.
You're sort of training this sort of new generation of diplomats.
But longtime critic Perry Link says Confucius Institutes are an example of China's soft power.
Hard power is military things, and soft power is cultural or educational things that cause people in other countries to view one's own country in a more friendly way.
Link says Confucius Institutes on university campuses is troubling because it limits academic freedom to discuss China's human rights issues.
It's induced self-censorship. That is, we're going to give you this fund, and you can invite speakers about China, and the fund comes from Beijing, and you know that, and we know that. Now, as the director of a Confucius Institute, do you think, oh, I'll invite the Dalai Lama to speak? No, Of course, you don't do that.
But the executive director of the UCLA Confucius Institute says it does not back away from touchy topics.
Whether it's artists that we present here who were active in sort of anti-government movement, or whether it's a screening of films that are that maybe are not approved by the officially approved by the government, that we don't shy away from that. But what we always tell our colleagues in China is that we promise to always present everything in a fair and balanced way.
The lasting impact of Confucius Institutes is up for debate, depending on one's perspective. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Happening now in Asia, hundreds of families from the southern Philippine city of Marawi are still evacuating 6 days after fighting between government troops and militants linked to Islamic State began. About 100 people have died because of the violence. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening. America is on the decline while China gains influence around the world. That's the premise behind Financial Times reporter Gideon Rockman's new book, Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, from Obama and Beyond. He spoke with Carol Castiel on VOA's Press Conference USA about what he sees as waning U.S. influence. And as VOA's Rebecca Ward tells us, Rockman points to changes in Africa as an example.
Financial Times chief foreign affairs columnist Gideon Rockman describes Easternization as the enormous burst of economic growth in Asia over the past 40 years. That, he says, has transformed the economic balance of power in the world.
Which is really a historic trend, because I think we've been for about 500 years in an era in which the West dominated the world, starting with the era of European colonialism, which began in the late 1400s. And then that transmitted from a period of European dominance to one of American dominance.
So countries that may have in the past looked to the United States for economic guidance, now, to use former President Barack Obama's words, are pivoting toward Asia. Just a few decades ago, it was assumed that only democracies could sustain economic growth.
The Chinese, I think, are serving as inspiration, if you like, for other countries or other regimes that do not want to yield to what they see as pressure to democratize.
Rockman says in the 1990s, the United States and Western institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund tried to tie lending and aid programs in Africa with democratic reforms.
And what the Chinese did in countries such as Ethiopia was to come in and say, look, we're not really going to make a fuss about that stuff. We're interested in doing business deals, will provide big loans for infrastructure. Your internal politics are not something that we care about. And for the more authoritarian African countries and regimes, that was actually quite an attractive offer. If you combine it with the enormous investments that the Chinese were able to make with their proven track record of fast economic growth domestically and of getting infrastructure projects done overseas, suddenly there was an alternative Chinese model in Africa, which I think they've been quite successful in pushing.
Case in point, Zimbabwe. At the recent World Economic Forum, longtime leader Robert Mugabe took issue with the description of his country as a failed state.
Yes, we have our problems, but certainly we have achieved our problems. We have resources, perhaps more resources than the average country in the world.
While the United States and other Western nations have shunned Zimbabwe for its human rights record, China's Premier Xi Jinping made a state visit there a year and a half ago, proposing further investment in southern Africa. But Gideon Rockman says a pivot to Asia is not necessarily a pivot toward authoritarianism.
China is the center of this phenomenon. It's the most powerful economy in Asia, and it is an authoritarian country. But there are other Asian countries, Japan, a major economy, but also perhaps most significantly in the long run, India, which is another country of over a billion people growing rapidly, 7-8% a year, that is a democracy, that doesn't accept the idea that Asian values and Easternization should be synonymous with a backlash against democratization.
Indeed, New Delhi has also reached out to Africa, hosting a summit 2 years ago in a bid to challenge Beijing's growing trade with the continent. India has a way to go, however. Trade between China and Africa topped $170 billion in 2015.
Our thanks to Carol Castiel and Rebecca Ward for bringing us the story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Takuma Sato became the first Japanese driver to win the Indianapolis 500. In the 101st running of the iconic U.S. auto race in the Midwestern state of Indiana, Sato passed three-time winner Hélio Castroneves of Brazil in the closing laps and held on to win by a slim margin of 0.2 seconds. You're up to date every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Australia has opened a so-called rescued food supermarket that operates on a take-what-you-need, give-what-you-can model. The Oz Harvest Market was founded by a South African-born entrepreneur and is part of international efforts to curb global food waste. Phil Mercer serves this report from Sydney.
The charity Oz Harvest was founded by Ronnie Khan in 2004. She was appalled by the amount of food wasted by Australia's hospitality services. In the past 13 years, Oz Harvest has received unwanted food from hundreds of restaurants and businesses and has delivered more than 60 million meals to the needy across Australia. It's now opened the country's first rescued food supermarket in Sydney.
The food that you're seeing in this supermarket today has come from everywhere in the food supply chain.
Khan says the project is helping to raise awareness of food waste around the world.
A third of all food globally goes to waste. That is unconscionable. And here in this free supermarket, where you can take what you need and give if you can, it's to put out into the public that opportunity to come in and learn, come in and engage, and it's a great collaboration.
It's estimated that food waste costs the economy about $15 billion a year. About a third of all discarded produce is thrown away by businesses, sometimes because vegetables and fruit have tiny blemishes or an irregular shape. Food waste campaigner Katie Barfield says corporate Australia is very wasteful.
Business models are set up to have waste. So imagine if you go into a bakery at the end of the day and there was just one loaf of bread. Now, that would be really good for the environment, but it would be really bad for the business because no one wants to buy that loaf of bread. And plus, no one's really wanted to go in there for the last half hour because there's nothing in there that looks particularly appetizing. So the way that industry works is it will just fill the shelves and it has to have a certain amount of product available at the close of trading. And so it deliberately produces waste.
Australia's Minister for the Environment and Energy is Josh Frydenberg. He says wasted food depletes other precious resources.
The excesses in the agricultural production, the land and the water that is wasted producing that surplus food that we don't eat, as well as the landfill and the environmental cost that we incur.
And then there's the issue of feeding the hungry.
With more than 600,000 Australians seeking food relief every month, we also have a moral imperative.
Under the UN Sustainable Development Goals, food waste is slated to be reduced globally by 50% by 2030. The Australian government has also adopted a similar target. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Developing at this hour in Asia, more torrential downpours forecast as an intensifying cyclone moves north toward Bangladesh. 195 people have died from flooding and landslides so far across India and Sri Lanka. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's an old riddle. What is the human body's largest organ? The answer is skin. And while it's certainly tough, skin's enemy is heat. Treating serious burns usually involves placing human or pig skin over the burn to help it heal. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us that doctors in Brazil are using a unique skin replacement that may also help the healing process.
Swimming around in these pools is a novel new way to treat burn victims. These are tilapia, a common, mostly freshwater whitefish that are often found on the menu. But these tilapia, or at least their skin, has a different final destination. The burn ward.
The most important step was when historical studies were carried out, and it was proved that tilapia skin has a great quantity of type 1 collagen, which is important for healing. It holds a high level of humidity and high resistance to traction, all of which makes it very similar to human skin.
Doctors in Brazil are covering burn victims in tilapia skin and have found it promotes healing, helps control pain, and reduces the need for costly antibiotics.
In the study of costs between using tilapia skin and sulfadiazine, tilapia skin reduces the cost by 75% throughout treatment.
Right now, there's only enough of the alternative fish skin to be used for research purposes, but patients who've used it say it works.
Don't do the treatment, which you have to change after 2 days. Use tilapia skin. It is excellent. It takes the pain away. You do not need to take medicine. In my case, I did not need it.
The team says they hope that saving fish skins for medical use will become part of tilapia processing. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, students at Stanford University in California in their Hacking for Defense class don't hit the books or work on problem sets in the library. Instead, they go out into the field tackling real-world problems given to them by the U.S. Department of Defense. VOA's Michelle Quinn checks out the unusual 10-week course, which is an eye-opener for the students who learn up close the challenges facing national security.
There are more than 100 entrepreneurship classes here at Stanford University. But in the Hacking for Defense class, students learn how to solve problems facing troops and defense agencies throughout the nation.
They want to work on some of the toughest real-world problems they're ever going to see. With all due respect to Google and Dropbox and Facebook and Twitter, which they all have opportunities here in the Valley to go work for as graduates here, these are some problems that make those look trivial by comparison.
So I will contend you probably now understand.
Blank and his fellow teachers launched the 10-week course last year to bring a model for creating startups to military and defense problems. Now the course is offered at 8 other universities. Student projects include helping soldiers in the field deal with mapping technology, creating sensors to help soldiers with injuries, and grappling with cybersecurity.
So I'm working with U.S. Transcom, which manages transportation in the United States, to better improve cybersecurity at the country's seaports.
Benji Nguyen is a graduate student in public policy. A native of Austin, Texas, Nguyen's parents are from Vietnam.
I've talked about this class, actually. I mean, their impression is that when I'm here, I'm, you know, studying, reading textbooks, or, like, doing problem sets. When I told them that I'm actually working with, like, the military to help solve a problem, they were really excited about that, actually.
For U.S. students, the Hacking for Defense class gives them a unique chance to serve their country. But the class has also attracted a surprising number of foreign-born students.
We take the military intelligence problems and we scrub them down so anybody could work on them. But I was surprised by the number of foreign students from Singapore and China, from India, who were just interested in learning that same methodology and could take it home from wherever they are.
Some students go on to create companies or go work for the agency they met in class. For some, like Bhuvanan Dayanandine, they are looking for work that is meaningful.
We are working on helping veterans that have experienced some polytrauma and figuring out how technology can increase their quality of life and their independence for a longer period of time.
The students in this class learn they have to first understand a problem before coming up with the right solution. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, at Stanford University in California.
VOA Asia can be heard on the radio, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung-Rung Christian University. Our special hello to everyone listening in Tainan, Taiwan. And a special thanks here in Washington to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Daryl Smith, managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including David Bird and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a wonderful day.